Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, yeah.
Good morning. I guess we're not going to have the British gal introduce us. So welcome, welcome, welcome to Unlimited Realities. I am your host, Lisa Zimmer, and I'm thrilled to start my new session of new programming for the season with my buddy Jeff Brown, who is an author and filmmaker, and his latest book we will be discussing, which is Ascending with Both Feet on the Ground. Later in our show today, we will also have a guest appearance with Vinnie Brownerini, who will be doing a movie review on Jeff's movie, Carmageddon. So I am really excited to share with you my friend and inspiration, Jeff Brown. Jeff, thank you so much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Lise.
It's a great, great fun time when we have a show, isn't it?
Usually, yep.
Usually,
I mean, sometimes
yes.
Vinny shows up and ruins the day.
Oh, I think Vin's, you know, Vin
comes in. I know, you like Vin. You like
I
him.
Like him. I like I him. He's real, you know.
He's
like real.
He is. He's a master of unrealment, absolutely.
You know, and you don't have to be, you know, full of light and love to be real. You can be a little caustic and a little sarcastic. You know, I have a little touch of that sarcasm in my humor, so I relate. I relate to Vin. So how you doing, Jeff?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. You know, I'm. It's been a busy summer finishing the film and getting the book ready for launch and starting to write again. So, you know, lots going on, but feel better than I did at the beginning of the summer. It just felt so daunting, but it feels good to complete projects. I love completing projects.
Well, yeah, you've done quite a lot. You've actually, you know, really come. I mean, for most people, we take off in the summer. You know, myself, I definitely slowed down, and now I'm having to gear back up. So it's I admire your tenacity and focus for the summer months. That's the time of play, especially up there in Canada, I would think. You get so many few months of sunshine and light.
I've read about that stuff. I'm working on it here. Yeah, that's nice. I'm working on my inability to notice the differences between the seasons. It's an overachiever's problem, I think. And I would actually like at some point soon to actually have something called the summer and go spend a month at Saratoga Racetrack in New York and climb the mountains in the Adirondacks. I have all these summer plans, but first I have to really notice that it's the summer.
Well, you know, it is summer. Come right around, you know, June 1st, people start shutting down a little bit, you know.
Okay.
And then around September 1st, they start gearing back up.
Okay.
But it's that whole, you know, it's like giving yourself a little vacation. But
right.
I guess, you know, it's that little honoring of the hard work you've done. Because you do an amazing job of, we're going to talk about your new book, but I really want to talk about, you know, you've really moved through so many things this year. This has been a really powerful year in, like you were saying, completing projects. You've really touched upon so many pertinent areas for spiritual growth and awareness and responsibility and integrity and unrealment. We'll get into all of that. So let's start with your latest work, the latest book, which is Ascending with Both Feet on the Ground. Great title. Talk about this. How did this come to be birthed? Was this a process over years, or was this something you sat down and focused on?
It was, you know, I was working on the film last fall, and the film was taking up so much time. It was an eternally annoying process, and I wanted to write and I was not really writing fresh. You know, I'm only now starting to really write again in terms of writing a new book. And so it just dawned on me at some point that I had a book waiting in terms of the quotes and excerpts that were moving so strongly in social media. You know, so in a way I had been writing those quotes for years. And so it became kind of a fun, it wasn't particularly aggravating. Like, soul shaping was very aggravating to re-edit and over-edit. I mean, it just went on forever and ever. And the quotes book was fun, just going through all these years of quotes and excerpts in my writings and social media and all of that stuff, just to pluck out the ones that had the most resonance for me. And so I did it last fall. I would like to do between business appointments and working on the film, I would just go to coffee shops and go through all these files and documents and pull out the best quotes. And I liked it. You know, I could see doing a quotes book every 3 or 4 years. Nowadays, people have such a hard time sitting down and reading a 200 or 300 page book. But if you can hit the key elements to support them on their journey in small little soul bites, I think it really might be the way to go. So I'm interested to see what happens with this book.
I find that a great and interesting topic, because I have spoken to so many people lately over the last few months, and they've said exactly what you just said, that, you know, time is of the essence, and it's they're finding it more and more difficult to sit down and finish, you know, a 200-page book.
We are so beyond overstimulated, and there's maybe some good elements of that, like maybe there are some nice benefits of interacting on social media, and, you know, and then there's the other side of it, which it becomes an addictive process, and we have so many of those in Western culture. And so what I like about Ascending is, like, even I have been carrying around the manuscript with me, so when I'm feeling a little off-center sometimes, I turn to a page or a couple of pages just to find something that reminds me. And this may be the direction that we're going to go with a lot of literature in the future, which is making it shorter, more succinct, more clarified, and so people can resonate with it quickly rather than just putting the book off to the side, not opening it for a long time.
And you know, and I have to say that between you know, I've done two live shows over the summer, and one of them, this is one, and the other one was back in July. I did Anthony Lawler, and he wrote a book.
Oh, I love Anthony Lawler. Yeah.
Oh, he's incredible, The 24
Brilliant.
Patterns of Wisdom. And it hit me so deeply when I read his book, and then knowing that you're coming out with this quote book, that you both totally inspired me to start my book. And my book changed so many thousands of times and ways that I'm doing exactly what you just said. I'm taking little bits and making it smaller and shorter and little mind bites, you know, little inspirational little hits. And so it's, you know, you both have such wisdom in the pages that I was going through the manuscript that you sent me on Ascending with both feet on the ground, and there were so many things that were going, yes. And let's talk about, first off, what is, for our listeners, let's explain what grounded spirituality is, because many times, you know, there's so many different concepts of spirituality, and you really bring it home in, you know, the enrealment piece, in dealing with the daily, you know, daily trudge of life and getting through things and maintaining this optimism and spiritual connection. So let's talk about, what is grounded spirituality?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I start with Ascending with both feet on the ground as a concept and as a vision of possibility. I played into ideas of spirituality that were inherently ungrounded. You know, I did the bliss trip, I did the head trip, I did the detachment trip, I did the witnessing the pain body trip, pretending it's not there anymore. I did the ask the universe for what I want and I'll get a trip for about 15 minutes. I did a lot of the ungrounded spirituality trips. And in fact, I don't even call those spiritual paths, because for me, at the heart of grounded spirituality is the idea that the word spirituality for me means reality. So the more spiritual my experience, it means that I'm in more elements of reality at one time. I'm not just parceling off the stuff that's comfortable and uncomfortable, separating them out and disconnecting from the stuff I don't want to deal with, and calling only the good stuff, the comfortable stuff, or the disconnected stuff spirituality. For me, it's all spirituality. And in Realman, really, you know, I was having a hard time with the commonly utilized definition of enlightenment, at least in Western culture, which seemed to be something about finding some disconnected zone, rarefied or heightened zone, that was far removed from the earth plane. And this, you know, that was the paternalistic trip, the lone wolf meditation warrior sitting in the meditation cave, disconnected from humanity. So the whole kind of feminine model, which was more relational, and where you expanded in your consciousness through this mysterious form of relationship was completely removed from the equation. And yet in my experience, the most spiritual moments I had in my life were relational, and the most spiritual moments I had in my life involved my accessing all aspects of my reality at one time, including the practical ones. And the most transformative moments I had in my spirituality happened through my healing or working through emotional material. So it was clear to me that spirituality was connected to all of these things at one time. And so grounded spirituality starts with the root chakra, grounded reality, practical needs, and works its way up from there so that when you ascend, if ascension is really what we're after, it's sustainable, it's grounded, you're really here for it. You're embodied, you're standing firm on the earth plane, you're available to the whole entirety of the life experience, and at the same time you're seeing things through a vaster lens.
Amen, because there's too much emphasis upon the light, I find,
yeah.
When
that's
the
not
shadow
spirituality.
Exists.
That's
no,
right.
And you can't have the light without the shadow. You can't
yeah.
have, you can't see your path without having a little bit of appreciation for the struggle that got you there. So it's like,
right.
there's this piece that, this bliss trip is just, to me, the most inane aspect of spirituality, because it doesn't encompass everything. It encompasses
no.
this little glimmer. And life isn't a glimmer. Unless you're going to stay, cocooned, you're not going to really experience the fullness of emotion and people and anger and frustration and all of these things that keep you in check and make you realize, hey, that's the bigger picture is. So it's, the enrealment piece, I know different people have different perceptions in regard to that word enlightenment and enrealment. I love it. I love enrealment because it really does bring you right back to your core, and it makes you accountable instead of passing it off as a, like you said, bliss trip.
Yeah.
So,
they're just feeling bypass models. The term spiritual bypass is the term that's used, and I've used it, and I know John Wellwood coined this phrase apparently, but spiritual bypass, it sounds like you're bypassing the spiritual. I mean, I think they're feeling bypass models. I mean, that's the basic motivation behind all of them. It's to get out of some realm of emotional experience that's uncomfortable by turning to some notion of God, non-duality, unity, or oneness. And through the eyes of enrealment or ascending with both feet on the ground, you would come to this experience of oneness. And if maybe non-duality, if that's really what we're after, I'm not sure it is, but if it is, by working through the localized experiences, So
right.
A very simple example is I grew in my spirituality. I matured in my capacity to hold all of it by working my core abandonment wound, right? The bypassers would never, ever talk about, and there's no relationship between the abandonment wound and real spirituality. The abandonment wound is your misidentified self, it's illusion, it's egoic, it's psychological, it's neurotic, whatever it is. As opposed to, in fact, that the grist for the mill of our transformation is our emotional material, our primary and challenging relationships, our callings and archetypal transformations. All the stuff that we're here to live in, live with, live to, and live through is what grows us in our spirituality. And I don't really know any other way of doing it. I can see
right.
perfecting a thread. You can become a master meditator. You can become a master of something called detachment, like Eckhart, right? Watching the pain body, watching it, till eventually you're not in it anymore. That doesn't mean
right.
it's not in you. It just means you're not in it, right?
Right,
so,
right.
That people come to you because they want to learn that technique. And sometimes we need to learn those detachment techniques because we do need an experience of a vaster consciousness, a glimpse into it, in order to be able to come back into our stuff and have the faith to keep moving. At least we know we're going somewhere better. So it's fantastic. Just don't call it enlightenment, and don't pretend that's the end of the story. At some point, you got to come back down into your body and work with what lives inside of you. If you don't consciously choose that, the universe is going to do it to you anyway.
Right.
So you may as well get on the enrealment train right now and save yourself a lot of time.
Right, and the enlightenment phase or stage or being or entity of awareness is, you know, I find it a bit fleeting at times, because they, of course you can have enlightened moments. There's enlightened awareness, there's enlightened moments, but to walk in enlightenment and to actually live life with all its trials and tribulations, you know, it's not a realistic term.
They don't even know what they mean by it. I mean, the whole problem is, what are we even talking about? I mean, if someone tells me they're enlightenment, what are they talking about? Are they telling me that they're God?
Right.
Are they telling me that they're holding the entirety of the God consciousness? If that's the case, they're completely deluded.
Right.
Are they talking
right.
about that they have a little bit more awareness than they had the day before? Fine, I've got no problem. I mean, I think when someone uses the word, we've got to really get into the nitty-gritty. What do they mean by spirituality? What do they mean by enlightenment? The game that I play with myself, and I've done this ever since I read Maslow as a teenager, is I try to paint a vision of possibility of what I imagine to be a whole human. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Forget enlightenment. A whole human, a healthy human, an awakening human. You know, what does that expanded consciousness or awareness look like, feel like? And, you know, some of the people who are out there talking about how they're enlightened or being defined as enlightenment, as enlightened, don't have any energy or feeling coming off their body. They're basically like automatons, like meditative automatons, right?
Right.
Really flatlined, really cerebral. I mean, they're disparaging the mind, but they're completely in their minds. Overdeveloped witness observers, not really able to jump into life anymore because it was too darn painful. They're not my vision of a whole being. For me, a whole being is more like Alexander Lowen in bioenergetics, you know, enlivened, sturdy, eyes on fire, full of life, full of feeling, healthily boundaried, you know, almost like, you know, a real sturdy version of Jesus, right? Like really enheartened, really solid, really energized, really here for it, almost like a Sufi, but with healthy
right.
boundaries. So if that's your vision of like expanded consciousness, then that's a whole other pathway of possibility. And I think before we even get into the stuff, everyone's got to sit back and draw a little picture on their etch-a-sketch of what a whole being looks like to them. And then that's where
right.
we start to talk about these concepts.
Well, you know, it's about, it goes right back into discovery of the self, because when you say let's draw a picture of what the whole being looks like, oftentimes people can't even draw a picture of their whole being, of what their aspirations, desires,
yep.
needs, wants are.
Yep.
So,
right.
you know, it's almost like let's focus upon, you know, the body and soul that you're carrying around and projecting light and love and anger and frustration outward and deal with that first. And then we can look at, okay, is the
right.
whole being something that, you know, we can aspire to be? Is it something that is in
right.
our framework of working towards? Because there's this piece. It's like talking to a couple and says, okay, well, what are you missing in your relationship? And they have no clue. So it's almost like a self-discovery of, okay, what's missing in me?
Right.
You
right.
know, and
but,
where
but,
do I go from here?
Well, the self, you know, the problem is the self has been vilified in two directions. The self has been vilified historically because we're all carrying forward, and this is the stage we're at in human development, we're all carrying forward the shamed self, right? And
right.
very few of us recognize the magnificence to be celebrated at the heart of this self, that this self is the soul. This is the stage we're at developmentally on a selfhood level is a direct reflection of where we're at in our individual soul's development. There is no split, but we're vilified in two directions. First, we're taught that it's egoic and selfish to be celebratory about the self. So that's level one. Level
right.
two, we now have the bypass movements coming along and saying there is no self. The self is substandard. The self is secondary. The self is toxic. The self must be disconnected from in order to find true spirituality. So the poor little self, which is all that we live in and know, this beautiful temple reflective of who we are spiritually, is bashed in every direction. And what we need to do is learn and do the work on the emotional plane, collectively and individually, to learn to love, honor, and celebrate the self, so that when we, instead of projecting God outward, we start looking in the mirror and understanding how close we are to God, how magnificent we are, and that this wonderful selfhood is our direct pipeline to divinity.
You have such great wisdom that just spills out from your higher self. You know, you just that was just really
my lower
beautiful.
Self. It starts in my feet, honey. I'm telling you, if there's any wisdom coming out of this guy, there it's in my feet. Because when I'm not making contact with the earth plane, I've got no wisdom at all. You know, this morning I did a lot of grounding practice, rubbing my feet into the carpet and into the ground, and so I feel more solidly present as a result of that. And I'm really getting it now. This journey is a soul-to-soul journey, but it starts with the S-O-L-E. It really starts there. And all these ungrounded spiritualists, they're just not in their bodies. They
you
left.
Must have some... Yeah, you're right. They have. They're just...
They don't
want to
be here.
They're vacuous.
They don't want to be here. And it's unbearable to face what they don't want to face, so they reframe it and upframe it as a heightened spirituality, and then you're immediately on a drug trip. You don't have to deal with your stuff anymore.
That's right.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
That's right. I know. Well...
Yeah.
Yeah. You've got to have some Pisces in you to be so feet oriented there, Jeff, because it is a full moon in Pisces coming in tomorrow, and that's the ruler of the feet, and the feet are the grounder, and I know this because I'm a Pisces. But let's talk about some of your quotes, because one of your quotes that one of my favorite quotes in your book is the following one I'm going to tell you. And it goes like this. And it says, there's no such thing as a fully realized master. That's just a hustle. We all have work to do. That's why we're here, to get a little closer. And, you know, that's kind of my ad nauseum with spiritual awareness, groupings, people, situations, events, is that too many people put this hierarchy on a masterful awareness.
Yeah.
And I do believe wisdom exists, and I do believe that there's incredible teachers with wisdom.
Yeah.
I don't look at any human being as a masterful, fully realized master.
Oh, gotcha. If they call themselves fully realized masters, they're usually just fully realized masturbators. That's really how I feel about it, and
right.
Honestly, and not to be kitschy, but it's true. And you know, like for my experience, those moments when I've had the best and deepest glimpses, say into an expanded consciousness or unity consciousness field, whatever you call it, enlightenment, whatever it is, the deeper I go into those experiences, the more I realize how far I have yet to travel. And to me, that's what's confusing and why it's upside down when people talk about themselves as whole beings. Because if, in fact, they've had those experiences, they know how far they have yet to travel. They know they are anything but fully realized. You know, if you do it numerically, if wholeness is 100, if we're living at 5, maybe we glimpse 8. And 8 is fantastic. It is like, what a beautiful experience to bring this whole mishpucha of madness together in our consciousness. But if you stay there for 5 more minutes, you realize there's 92 more levels you haven't gotten to yet.
Right.
If they don't realize that, then they're not anything close to realized. I mean, if anything, the most expanded moments bring us to a more humble place in ourselves.
Right. And you know, there's this as I'm going through your book and I'm listening to you, you are touching on the next aspect I was going to bring in to discuss, which is another quote that you have in here. And what I love about your book is I love books that teach me something, that, you know, aren't just repetitive, recycled words from some other author. I love a book that has a new approach, new perspective, you know, tweaks me a little. So what I also love is having a book that you need a little insight, okay, and you have it in your lap, and you open it up randomly, and you read a page, and there's exactly what you needed to hear for the day. Those books get me. And this is what your book's all about, is that every page has something for your soul to reflect upon, to kind of ponder through the day, to explore in a perspective, in a new awareness. And one of the ones that come through here in regard to what you were just talking about is this one that it's kind of lengthy, so I'm going to read it, but it's a little lengthy, and it says, If we don't know where we end and the other begins, we will have a difficult time establishing healthy connections. Those of us with weakly formed boundaries will be easily manipulated and influenced, often confusing our partner's feelings for our own. Those of us with firm boundaries will have a hard time opening our hearts to love. Our walls are simply too firm to penetrate. People with healthy boundaries tend to live somewhere in between. They have the capacity for vulnerability and self-protection at all times. When they do move toward one polarity, they do so with intentionality. In all cases, their sense of self remains intact. And that is sorely, shall we say, there's not enough folk like that.
There ain't too many folk like that out there, Lisa. Healthily boundaried, fully unrealized masters, absolutely. Hard to find.
Hard,
no,
you know?
Hard
and,
to find.
And there's
but that's
so many.
You know, it's a, yeah.
There's so many reaching that or seeking that, but to really embrace that whole authenticity, the good, the bad, the ugly, and embrace it and love it and tweak it and evolve it, you know, it takes a really brave soul. It really does.
It's hard work. It's hard
work.
It's divine perspiration. It is hard work. This is an unconscious world still. I mean, you're up against it. If you want to go, it's one thing to open the door a little. It's another thing to keep pushing the door open for 60 or 70 or 80 years. It's not an easy path. You have to be on fire for it. You have to want truth so bad on every level that you are willing to suffer through your whole life to find it. And that's it. And few of us have that kind of stamina, karmic stamina. You know, and I'm not sure I have that stamina. You know, I've pushed myself hard for a long time. And, you know, now I just want to go like head out of the racetrack. You know, it's like I really get it. It's the vibration of the world outside of me, at least culturally, is not supporting this inquiry. You know, of course there's more interest in it now and people are reading more about it. But still, there's a level, in terms of the deep, deep, deep work, the real hardcore school of hard knock stuff, I've known very few people who really do it and who can really handle it. And we're just not there yet.
No, and it's a scary concept because people have an assumption of going into a place and not coming out. And they're not looking at it as walking through and coming out the other end. They're looking at it as staying stuck in the muck, you know?
Well, because it is mucky, and because the muck... How many people I work with in private sessions say to me, you know, when is this going to end? You know, how much longer? You know, how about your fucking lifetime? That's how much longer. And, you know, where did you get an idea? Well, I know where you got an idea, in cheeseball Western culture, in substitute gratification culture, that it was going to take about 7 weeks, and then you were going to be healed, cured, and live a complete actualized life. Who are you kidding? I mean, even if you can clarify your path, actualizing your path is hard enough in the world. And then if you're wealthy somehow and you can afford to go off and do all of these things, you still got to deal with the vibration of the culture not resonating with where you're coming to and the isolation that comes from that. And so, you know, and not to paint a dark picture, it can be incredibly gratifying to find and to live your true path, but it is an ongoing hard work process.
Yeah, it's not going to end. And it's like it's akin to like 30-day detox programs for drug-addicted people. Sure, your body will detox in 30 days, but the soul and the mind carries that addiction until it's healed. And so, you know, 30 days is barely going to scratch the surface of the addictive mind. And it's an addiction we carry around in our concepts, in our thoughts, in our being of old programming, of old religions, of old beliefs. And so all of this has to be rediscovered. And it has to be almost like, you know, brand new eyes, brand new awakening, brand new perception. And finding myself going through this with my 16-year-old son right now who's questioning a lot of spirituality, religions, beliefs, all of this. And we had like a 2-hour discussion at dinner last night. And he's, you know, he's asking really great questions. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, so I didn't raise them in a structured, traditional religious base, you know. And there's been times where I've wondered, you know, did they need some sort of foundation or something that rooted them in the community? And I'm listening to his wisdom, and I'm thinking to myself, damn, this is my 16-year-old kid. And, you know, and I see how when people can get out of a box thinking where their mind takes them, where their heart evolves them to. And you have such great real reflections. I mean, every page here, you have to kind of like, aha. So I'm taking you to another one here, another page, and it says, when I look back at my life, I want to feel as though I have done all I can to honor my voice authentically. I am not concerned about how much money I have made, but instead how much karmic currency I have created. Karmic currency accumulates when we honor our path faithfully and share our inner riches with those we encounter. Let's open a joint account. Now, let's talk about that, because a lot of times people right now, especially with, you know, the negative economy and everything, people are really questioning what they're doing. And many times they've had to let go of certain aspects of their lives, jobs, homes, things. So they're looking at their life through scared eyes oftentimes, and they're wondering, are they doing enough and what can they do? So let's talk about how living authentically and developing that karmic currency can help those scared souls really look at different opportunities that could come to their lives. Like, what is karmic currency? You know,
this is how I think of it. Like, I can only really speak from my experience, but my experience has been that when I made money, good money, there was an initial phase of relief because all my anxieties about not having money faded away. So I was like honoring the security issues, right? I was like, I was on the survivalist bridge, which is where this planet has been since the beginning. And we're only now trying to shift our orientation from survivalism to authenticity, right? This is why it's so shaky. And so when I would make good money, it would be like I'd feel great for a little while. And then after I kind of got that in my bones, that need was met, my consciousness immediately went to the question of like, okay, now what's next? What am I here to do and to be and to become? And my experience has been the gratification I have found at knowing why I'm here. You know, when I can sit down to write and I'm really in it and I know that that's why I'm here, you know, is so much more deeply, meaningfully gratifying than any of the satisfactions I've ever gotten on the material plane. And, you know, so this shift in the structures of survivalism, that is that the game that's been working forever isn't working so well anymore, is a wonderful opportunity for us to ask the ultimately more meaningful question, which is, why the hell am I here?
Mm-hmm.
And what am I going to do with the time that I've been given? I think that was Gandalf's question. What are you going to do with the time that you've been given?
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful question. And it's a precious question to hold your soul in your heart's imagining and ask that question. What am I going to do with the time that I've been given? And so instead of being stuck in, now, if you have no money and you can't get food, and I mean, you have to have your consciousness focused on meeting your needs. There's no game about that. That's the real deal. But if you're okay enough, now's the time to ask that question. What is my sacred purpose? What are my soul scriptures? What gifts do I have to open? What gifts do I have to gift back to humanity? How can I be of service to myself and to others and their spirituality? And, you know, it's all in how you look at it.
It is. And it's an important piece to kind of allow yourself to have your mind wander and explore different concepts. And brings me to my next one. It's important to grant yourself permission to wander as part of the spiritual journey. So often mischaracterized as lostness, there is a kind of immersion in the not knowing that is actually quite necessary if we're going to find our way home. So much information can come up when we're looking in no particular direction. By surrendering to the unknown, we create the space for a deeper knowing to emerge. In the heart of the not knowing, the paths that we are here to walk reveal themselves. That's just beautiful.
Flake it till you make it.
Yeah, but it's one of those things where there's that discomfort. You know, you're uncomfortable in stepping outside of your comfortable little box that you've created for 10, 20, 50 years. And here there's, you know, you're dipping your toe into new water, and you're bashing down the sides of the box. So it's okay to question is what I get from this. It's okay to question yourself, your beliefs, spirituality, God. And, you know, by questioning that the answers reveal themselves in your search.
Just live your confusion. You know, it's, you know, there's such an emphasis on having the answers. I mean, it starts in primary school, you know, having to know the answers. And, you know, the place that we move from one habitual way of being to a new form is in the not knowing. You know, it's the monkey that's letting go of one vine and hasn't quite fully grabbed onto the next one and has to hang there in this very uncomfortable place. If you have a lot of early life associations with the unknown as terrifying or violent or anything like that, it's going to be very difficult for you to grow in your spirituality, because in order to grow in your spirituality, you can't jump from knowing to knowing. It just doesn't work that way. So many parts of us dig in their heels, familiar, habitual ways of being, gripping tightly, not letting go of the thing we know best. Even bad habits are still comfortable because they're habits. And to jump into a new set of eyes, a new way of operating in your body, a new emotional range, is huge. And so often requires us to just sit down or lay down on the couch and feel into this confusion, not to vilify the confusion, but to recognize it, that it's actually a sign that our soul is wanting to grow.
And how does that differentiate between the monkey mind, which is the next aspect I'm going to get into on?
Yep.
Because you have the monkey mind feeds on small peanuts, tireless anxieties, petty jealousies, fearful imaginings. Starve it by swimming in a vast ocean of delight.
Yeah.
I believe the monkey mind is a really an epidemic in our society, because there's such a one-upmanship and such a desperation that's being fed through the media and the airwaves that it's easy for the monkey mind to get a hold. And really, really important to be mindful of that.
Well, so ironic that you said it's important to be mindful of that, because the problem with the monkey mind is that we're full of mind. And really, I don't think there is any such thing truly as the monkey mind. That's my most ungrounded quote in the entire book, actually. I have my questions about that quote, because I think what we have is a monkey heart. What's really happening is that the emotional body, we've moved our energy up high. We're surviving by our wits. We're head tripping. We're cycling energy up high. The neck is blocked. We're not feeling into our breath. We're not feeling into our bodies. If we do the work to get rid of this so-called monkey mind, we have to clarify our emotional body. We have to clear out the monkey heart, bring the energy back into the body, open the lines again, break through the emotional holdings and obstructions, and then the mind completely calms down. Right? That's why meditation is often not the path, because meditation for head trippers just takes them farther into their heads, right? Head trippers need to get out of their heads and get into their bodies. They need to dance. They need to run through the woods. They need to have ferocious sex. They really need to get physical. They need to clear emotional debris. They need to smash the bed. They need to move their rage, and then the mind calms down. You know, so for me, I've always found that that thing we call the monkey mind is actually a direct manifestation of a blocked emotional rhythm.
And
the whole culture is living there, because nobody,
right.
They're sitting in their cars, driving on the highway, worrying about money, completely not in the physical body. The culture is completely disembodied. There's so little room or time for real deep emotional work, like the old bioenergetics work they did in the 60s and 70s. There's no time for it anymore. And so the head trip is getting more embedded. And then this thing called the monkey mind gets stronger. But the solution to it is to come back down into the body. We've got to create space for a real life inside of this temple. Otherwise, there's no hope for us.
And there's this almost like there's a feeding that's going on in regard to monkey mind, monkey heart, monkey awareness. There's this piece of better than, less than, greater than, and I love this one that you have. It kind of sums up that what you just said. You're either in or you're out. Sometimes it's that simple. No more stories, no more sidestepping, escape hatches, veiled retreats. You're either in or you're out. Now, talk to us about what that, where that came from in your soul, and what you meant by that.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, so often when people write, they write for themselves, you know, and I was writing that for me. I mean, it has resonance for other people, I know, but I was really talking about, you know, there's a way in which as my path unfolds, I'm pushing, always pushing this edge of my scriptures. I'm like, you know, I'm recognizing what is the next step in my path. And the steps that I'm taking seem to keep pushing me out into sort of public, some degree of public presence, you know, particularly in social media. And that's really uncomfortable for me. You know, I mean, that's probably a big reason why I've manifested this path. Part of me just wants this to end and stop so I can go back into hiding, you know.
Okay.
But I know on some level that I can't do that yet. Or maybe I can't ever do that. And that I know that the next thing I have to do, the next book, the next thing, is pushing me outward, farther outward. So these things are both happening at the same time. And I wrote that for me just to inquire into and to motivate me to keep going to my edge, to be in my life completely, which means to be in my sacred purpose, rather than honoring the part of me that wants to hide and run away. You know, it's all over my Vedic chart. This has been always true in my life that, you know, I a part of me wants to come into the world and do good work in the world for humanity, and a part of me wants just to be left the fuck alone.
Right.
It's a very interesting polarity, you know.
Well, it's kind of honoring the balance, you know, putting the boundaries in perspective for yourself in regard to, okay, I'm out there and now I'm in, and I'm protected and nurturing myself, and like you were saying earlier, you know, there's nothing wrong with retreating in regard to self-nurture or to take care of
heart. Absolutely, but that's not what my issue is. My desire is to simply not be in the world and to not deal with the madness of the world at all. What you're talking about is the only way I can manage this, which is correct, which is I have to be able to pull back and take care of myself and have a life that's very individualized and with my close friends and like that whole thing. But it's for me, it really is about this question. I think a lot of people have this. You know, I have one of my quotes, it'll be in the next quotes book, relates to, you know, being a seeker or a finder. I don't think I put it in this book. And so often we stay in seeker mode because it's a hiding place. You know,
right.
We already have information about what we need to do next. We just don't want to live it because
Then
we're at risk of failing at it, or we're going to be noticed, or we're going to have our early life memories of like being mocked for it, or whatever it is in the individual that comes up. So we go back and do another weekend workshop because we've got to find something we haven't found yet. Sometimes that's true. These books and workshops are fantastic at the right moment on the path. But at some point, they become a form of self-abuse, you know, or a self-avoidance.
Or addiction.
Absolutely, because really, we, you know, a lot of us have a lot more information about the life we're here to live than we're letting on, either
right.
to other people or even to ourselves. And it's so, you know, it that's what that quote was about. You're either in or you're out. I'm either in this path or I'm sidestepping it and walking off to the side of it.
And so I'm going to finish talking about the quotes book with this last quote, and then I'd like to move over to your movie that you produced and filmed, a documentary, Carmageddon, and introduce Vinnie Brownarini, who will be doing a movie review of the movie.
Hold on, I got to tell him. Vinnie, you're on soon. Okay.
Okay. So the last quote that I want to share, which I really feel really summarizes what you just said and really brings it home for everyone, is a true master follows her own footprints encoded within her before arriving in this incarnation. Someone else may remind her, someone else may empower her, but no one else can possibly know the unique contours of her own true path. Since you are the only one living in your temple, only you can know its scriptures and interpretive structure. The next step is right there inside you, divinely imprinted on the soles of your feet. Amen. That's beautiful.
And souls is spelled S-O-U-L-S. Isn't it? I think it is. I hope it is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really a good one.
That was
one of my faves.
I like that quote, actually. I don't like all of my quotes, but I like that quote because I grew up in an environment, in survivalist environments, they're trying to help you. So they tell you who to marry and what's a good practical union job, and from a survivalist structure where all they're thinking about from where they come from is food on the table, basic needs being met, they're really doing the right, they're being of service, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for those of us who want something more than that, something deeper, more refined, more genuine than that, then we have to look in a different direction, and the place to look is inside of us. Nobody else can possibly
Amen.
Know the calling. No guru, any guru who tells you what you're here to do is a big fat liar. It's just ridiculous.
Right.
And because, you know, it is so deep and so personal and so privately encoded in your unique being that the only one who can find that is you. And I feel like it's the most important message in the book in its own way.
It really is. That's why I wanted to finish with it, because it really brings it all home. So before, we have like 15 minutes left, so I want to introduce Vinny. And Vinny is one of my favorite interviews, because
right.
nobody's more real than Vin.
No.
Vinny Brownerini is going to – he has watched Carmageddon, which is a film that Jeff produced and starred in. It's a documentary on spiritual teachers and masterful awareness. So without further ado, Jeff, bring on Vinny.
Hi, Elise.
Vin, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm hungry, but I'm good.
I'm a little hungry, too.
Yeah, I had a old cannoli this morning. I'm waiting for them to – the girls going to pick up some fresh ones.
Well, that's important. You have to have a fresh cannoli. There's no sense having the old stale ones. It kind of hangs around a little bit. Now, I hear you saw the movie Carmageddon.
Yeah, I saw that movie. Yeah.
What'd you think? Pretty cool, huh?
You know, I don't know. I never understood what he was doing with that guy, honestly. But it doesn't make any sense. Now, I used to hanging out with his family, and nobody understood. He watched them walking down the street together like old friends. Seemed crazy. I never seen. I mean, Jeff's normally a pretty sensible person, but I don't know. But
well, he had a story to tell. You know, he had some truth to reveal. He had to do this. I mean, this was an important.
I mean, the guy thinks he's a reincarnation of Anne Frank. I mean, what kind of a lunatic is that? Why does he pick Anne Frank? Why not Mahatma Gandhi, for God's sakes?
Right. You're right. You're right. There's some sort of, I don't know, there's some strange vibe there. There's, you know, what really, did you find that it gave you a bad taste in regard to so-called spiritual teachers, or did you put it in context with the person?
I never had a good taste for nobody who calls himself a spiritual teacher. The whole thing's ridiculously ungrounded in my view. I mean, you either are somebody that people come to learn, or you're not. You don't call yourself a spiritual teacher. Listen, I'm going to tell you what I think of this movie. It's a very colorful film. It's a very good, very, very good film. It makes you very emotionally excited. You know, I'm watching it. I want to eat. I'm stuffing down the feelings. I've got what Jeff calls triggers happening, you know. So
right,
I know the
right.
movie's a good movie. It's not one of those documentaries that makes you go schluffy. You know what I mean?
No, you're definitely not going to sleep through this one.
No. But the thing is, I really feel I don't like the dude with the orange clothes and the hair. I don't like that guru guy. But I think they're too hard on him with respect to the feminine, okay? These broads come to him because they want something too, okay? I know because I got a lot of money. I got my own tennis court. Chicks know about me before I walk in the room already. They're already angling for me. So these girls get something out of this experience with this guy too, this Baba guy. So you can't just put it all on the Baba. That's all.
You're
and
right.
I'm not as, I don't like him. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
But I think everybody's got a part to play in this human fray, as I like to say.
You are a poet. Do you know it?
Listen, I've been doing some writing, but I'm not ready to come out with that. But that's one of my cliches that I like to use around the house.
Now, in seeing this movie, and you know, there were some really aspects of this movie that makes a lot of people want to throw up. So did you feel that way?
Yeah, I felt everything. I felt angry. I kept punching Jeff when I was watching the film because I couldn't believe that he hooked his horse to this wagon, whatever that saying is. I had a very strong emotional. So it was evocative, as my therapist says. It was an evocative experience. I was very angry. I was tantruming. I was very peaceful during the Ram Dass. Made me peaceful, like slow, nice, beautiful.
Yeah, Ram Dass was cool, wasn't he?
Then Jeff's family reveal and all, you know, didn't know these things. He doesn't share these things. He writes about things, but he doesn't talk anymore. He's like a quiet man now. So I had to learn about my buddy from this film. But it really is Carmageddon. But I do think it's important to stop vilifying the dude. I really want to stress this. And really, it's something we could talk about, and I know we don't have time right now, but really talk deeply about how the genders work each other. Because if we don't look at it that way, we're not going to make things better.
No, we're not. And there has to be some sense of responsibility for everyone. Like you said, everyone plays a role. Everyone has a part. And, you know, he's not going to be able to have a screw fest if there aren't willing participants. So, you know,
yeah, nobody called him a rapist, so there's participation.
Exactly.
You know, now, having said that, the scene where he talks about, like, he's 18 and he says he has sex with this 13-year-old Egyptian whore, he says. Now, I understand back then, being 18, that wouldn't occur to you necessarily to be a horrible thing to do. But I don't understand, now that he's over 60 years old and has had children of his own, why he's not compassionate towards the plight of that child.
Right.
So I see that too. I'm talking more about him with all the adult girls, but not the young girls. That's a whole other story for me.
Yeah, that's a whole...
I was never my trip, you know. And even now when I go out with a dame, you know, and because I'm 62. You know, and I'm still virile, don't get me wrong, but I'm 62. So, but if a dame's like under 40, I don't want to go out with her. I say, I have a talk with her, or I have a heart-to-heart over dinner. I say, why are you here? Are you looking for a daddy, or are you looking for a sugar daddy? What's your motivation?
Good for you, Vin.
Yeah,
that's really putting
because
the
I know
cards
she's,
on the table
she's
there.
She's not a, she's empowered. She's making her choice. No one's forcing her to be at the table with me sharing ravioli. So there's a reason for it, and I want it on the table. I don't want anyone lying. I don't want no unconscious. So if we go and have a little nookie in the car after dinner or something, I want us to know where we stand.
And that's what it all comes down to, because if you can't be honest within, you know, your personal relationships, who can you be honest with? You know, you're not honest with yourself.
We need to get everything on the table early in every part of our life.
Yes,
amen. Don't cover it over with blankies. Just get it on the table.
You know, it's so much easier to live in truth. I mean, you know, I know that it sounds easier than it actually is, but once you cross that threshold into really vowing to yourself that every aspect of life and living and communication is going to come as truthful from the heart as possible, it's not that hard. I think the hard part is making the crossover from, you know, just giving the little pieces of truth and holding back the entirety. Because, you know, it's the good, the bad, the pretty, the ugly. You know, there's
life. Childhood is it all happens in childhood, Lisa. We form these ideas to protect ourselves about living under disguises. And what we don't realize is that it's actually easier as an adult to come out from under the disguise. I'm working very hard in my psychotherapy to come out from under my disguise.
Well, I think you've come a long way, Vin. I mean, as we have talked in many shows, you know, I've listened to you. Your evolution has been astounding to me because, you know, Jeff's a good friend to have to help guide you along, whether he talks to you or not. You know, he's there as you know, he's supportive.
Yeah, he's a putz. I don't want to give him too much credit, but I love him.
I don't think he's a putz, but, you know, I don't live with him. So.
That's exactly. You don't see him every day with food on his face, you know, unshaven, pants on backwards, because all he wants to do is write. He's not aware of the world. It's not a pretty sight, let me tell you. I get dressed every day. I put on my thing. I have a ritual so that when I face the world, I face it in a certain way. He doesn't care how he looks. He couldn't care less at all.
And I bet you slap on a little cologne and smell real good, too, don't you, man?
I still use Brut. I'm not ashamed to admit it.
It's exactly the visual I had of you. Exactly.
Yeah. I don't put on too much, but I put on a little something.
Hey, better to smell something good than something not good.
Absolutely. That's right.
Now where do you feel like this is a movie that everyone should see? Do you feel like this is a movie? Okay, and why?
Yes, because it's not just, this movie's not about this crazy guru guy. This movie, at its heart, is about why do we summon certain people into our lives? What lessons are we learning? Why do we keep mapping it out like this? Because everybody's gotten involved with a doofus. Everybody's gotten involved with the wrong person. The real important thing is what, and I give Jeff some credit, because at the end of the movie, instead of just blaming the Bubba, which was easy with this guy, they go to the next level and they say, Jeff says, why did I bring this into my life? And this is the most important question to ask in our lives. Why did I summon this relationship into my life? What's my piece in this? And that's not to say the other person isn't accountable for their behavior, but we got to learn something from it too, because we made a choice to be in that connection.
Well, I think, you know, what Jeff did, even in having to mingle with him, was a very powerful thing to do. It was something that needed to come into our lives as people who are aware of spirituality, and also to make people accountable for giving their power away to, you know, others instead of, you know,
exactly.
The real heart of the matter lies within. So, you know, I found this film so, so valuable, and I've passed it on to so many people, and it's just been really an eye-opener for everyone that I've handed it to, because I can't tell you how many of my own friends have given power away to gurus or masters or teachers and almost hail them like a Jesus Christ. And it's disturbing to me.
It's just delusional. We're just as Jeff's true what he says, trying, we can see God outside of ourselves. We just can't see God in the mirror yet. That's the work I'm doing in my psychotherapy, is being able to see God in the mirror.
Well, I think that the God in you, Vin, is a beautiful soul of truth and insight, and you have a tremendous reality and genuine soul, and that's what I love about you. You know, Jeff always teases me that I have this crush on you, but honestly, it's
you're not the
soul
only one.
Thing.
Yeah, well, you're not the only one. You know, and I'm not giving myself too much credit. I have a lot of work to do on myself, but I really pride myself in being really very straightforward now. I think that people really welcome it, because it removes all the nonsense from the table right when we sit down. How wonderful
right.
is that? We can really sit down and have a sharing now. And
that's right.
What we need we don't know how long we're here. So while we're here, we need to share with each other
and we need to walk the truth. Yeah, it's
absolutely.
Amen.
Absolutely.
You know,
I don't want to walk alone all the time. I don't want to play tennis against the wall. I like when there's somebody else playing tennis with me.
Right, right. And that's what it's about. It's about learning to be in relation with others and not be triggered by where they're coming from. And that's an important piece, whether you're giving power away to a relationship or you're giving power away to a teacher. It's important to be really aware of your own power, your own beauty, your own essence, Then we have about 45 seconds. I want to thank you, Vinnie Brownerini, my movie review for Carmageddon, and Jeff Brown, author and filmmaker of Carmageddon. Thank you so much, both of you, for being my guests today on Unlimited Reality. You
well,
have been just a joy.
My pleasure, and I'll say goodbye to Jeff for you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You guys have a great tennis game today.
Yeah.
Eat lots of cannolis.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll toast you some cappuccino to go.
We'll see you again soon, I'm sure.
All right, Vin. Take care. God
Bye.
Bless. Thank you for joining us today, everybody. Have a wonderfully blessed week. Bye-bye.